I'm an alcoholic, and my name is J.C. I guess the other panelists are still praying and meditating. My sobriety date is April 19th, 1992. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that morning of April 19th. It was a Sunday morning. And I had a lot of issues. And you know, 20 years ago, you could have never convinced me that today I would be standing in front of a group of people talking about my experience with prayer and meditation. You know, I come from a background of absolutely non-religious, so the whole idea of spirituality and this other part of the mind and this whole other spiritual world was all very foreign to me. And hocus pocus, and I classified God with the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and things like that. And that's just how I looked at it. But, you know, we started this meeting with the Serenity Prayer. And that's probably the first prayer that I ever said with any that I started really utilizing. And you know, when I came in, they gave me that little token, the newcomer's chip, you know, and it says one day at a time on one side, or to thine own self be true on one side, and then on the other side it usually has the Serenity Prayer. And I started learning that prayer, and I remember when I was sober just a few days, I got hit with that obsession to drink, and somebody had told me, you know, just grab that chip. And I remember I was thinking about it. I was driving over to a buddy's house, and I started that obsessive nature started coming into me, and you know, and in the past, you know, I tell myself, oh, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to go over to my buddy's house, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, and but I just keep going over there, and I get all the way over there, then I think, oh, I'm only going to have one, I'm only going to do this, I'm only going to do that, and you know, we just get shit faced, and it happened over and over and over, you know, over my life, and this particular time, I was heading over there, and I got scared, I got in kind of a panic, I didn't know what to do, you know, because I could see with some kind of clarity from hanging around the AA meetings that I was probably going to pick up that day, and I didn't want to, you know, starting this new life. So I remember I pulled out that chip. Somehow that chip came to my mind. I was carrying it in my pocket, and I pulled it out, and the one day at a time thing, that didn't ring a bell with me, but I flipped it over, and I saw that prayer. And I remember somebody saying, you know, if you get in a tough spot, start saying that prayer. And I'd never prayed before. You know, I really had never prayed. I was 42 years old and basically didn't pray. And I turned that chip over and I started saying that Serenity Prayer. And after a couple of minutes, I did something that I hadn't done very often in the past. I turned the wheel and went to where I was supposed to be going that day. I had my own business, so I could screw up quite a bit, you know. But that day I went and did my deal, you know. And I was impressed by that. I was impressed by that, you know. Why did that work? You know, why did me just saying these little prayers, all of a sudden, my whole mind changed, and after I totally forgot about this thing, and I got out of that obsessive train that I was on. I was like on a train. I was on a single track. I wasn't going to be able to get off. Never had been able to get off. And all of a sudden, I was able to get off and go do these things and not be bothered by it. And so that was pretty impressive to me. I've met a lot of people that have very, very impressive similar situations, and so I started becoming, you know, open to these ideas, you know, and I started listening more to people, and that was about the only prayer that I'd say for a long time, and I was really stuck on step one when I got here. Step one is there's a lot of new people here, I'm going to go through the steps a little bit here because I got a little extra time, it looks like, and I'd like to. I mean, a lot of you people that are new, I mean, you have no idea what step 11 is probably, and I don't know how many people have actually gone through the steps here, but I know there's a lot of new people here. So step one, you know, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. I mean, powerless over alcohol, or powerless over whatever drug it is, or drugs. I was powerless over drugs and alcohol, and my life was unmanageable. You know, I didn't like either one of those statements. I didn't like saying I was powerless over anything. I mean, that sounds pretty pathetic and pretty weak, and my life's unmanageable. You know, well. Yeah, some areas, you know, and some areas maybe not, you know. So these things were like, they rubbed me kind of wrong, you know, because I wouldn't look at a lot of things. You know, here I was like, within a few weeks of coming into the program, I was homeless. That truck that I was riding around with was broken. You know, I was unemployed. My girlfriend had left me. I mean, just everything, it just fell apart very quickly. And still, it was hard to say because I had an up and down life, you know. So in this particular time, I was crashing and burning. But I had to take a look at that powerless. And I'd been in AA before. And I'd had several years of sobriety. And hadn't really gotten into the steps. I got into meetings. And meetings are not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings are a good thing, but they are not the 12 steps of Alcoholics, not the 12 steps of the program. And I didn't really get into the program very much. I went through them real quick just to say I'd done them and then went on and lived my life the way I wanted to live my life, which you can do in here. You can really live the way you really want to live here, the way you really want to live, not the way you've been living, the way you really want to live. You can do that here. But I started coming to grips with the idea that I was powerless over alcohol, you know, because I was able to start looking at my life, you know, working with a sponsor and taking this stuff seriously. We listened to the people in the meetings. I started identifying, and I became powerless over alcohol in my mind, powerless over drugs. I started realizing that they were a primary cause in every situation in my life where I really screwed up. And they were there. And they were there when I didn't want them to be there. They were there when I wanted them to be there. They were there when I said they weren't going to be there. I got them there, you know. They were there all the time. And so I started looking at this, that, you know, I was an addict. I was addicted to alcohol. And I was addicted to other stuff, you know. That I really was that, you know. And that as an addict, I didn't have control. And if I didn't have control over that, then I really didn't have control over my life. My life was really unmanageable because I couldn't tell you when I was going to start drinking or using other stuff, and I couldn't tell you when I was going to stop once I started. And I had no control over how much I took once I got in. So I didn't know if I was going to stop in a day or two or three. And, you know, that's really like some kind of weird dream because I have no control. I'm like in a dream world, you know, where things are happening and I'm out of control. And I started looking at it like that. You know, I started realizing, you know, I'm a pretty effed up individual, you know. And then the second step said, came to believe a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity. I started understanding that I was kind of crazy, you know, that I wasn't acting sane, that I was thinking that it was perfectly normal to start drinking and using and then be off for days or weeks or whatever and be out of control. I was thinking that was normal, and that's not normal. You know, and you can't get much done in life. You can't have good relationships in life. You can't be trusted. You can't even trust yourself because you tell yourself you're not going to do something and you're off and running. So I started realizing I was crazy. I was crazy. And then I started believing a power greater than myself to restore my sanity. And initially, you know, like I said, it was the serenity prayer and the group. You know, the group, the people in the room, these people that had some sobriety and had walked through this and had something that they were giving. They radiated something, and I didn't know what it was, but they had it. And when I got to a meeting, I seemed to get it. And when I left a meeting, I seemed more powerful than when I got there because I would deplete as I got away from a meeting, and I'd come back to a meeting, and I'd get kind of filled up with this kind of spirituality, and I could walk out, and I had more strength to face my demons, so to speak. And then I was looking at, you know, I'd come to believe that AA was going to help me and the 12 steps were going to help me. But I still didn't have any kind of belief in God. I didn't know what to think about that. You know, I had a lot of issues there. And these were deep, hardcore issues with the whole idea of spirituality, God, and all this kind of stuff. And I'd seen people over my life that had great strength. They were believers and had great strength. And then I've seen people that were just complete hypocrites that I couldn't stand. And they would talk out of one side of their mouth, and they were great on Sundays, you know, Sunday mornings. And the rest of the week, they seemed more like me than they were like they were talking on Sundays. And so a lot of them had these real pinched up faces that I didn't like. Very pious looking. And so, you know, I had these issues, and they were deep, and they were formidable. They weren't something I was just going to walk through, you know, because I was looking at that third step, and, you know, I turned my will and my life over to God as I understand Him. Jesus, what does that mean? I turned my will and my life over. Man, that's like, that sounds crazy to me, you know, and that's how I thought, you know, but it took me a while. I thought long and hard about that, you know. And it says in the book, you know, to think long and hard about it, and I did. And if I was going to do that, I wasn't going to be like all the hypocrites I'd grown up with. You know, I was either going to do it or not do it. I'm going to be all in or all out. You know, I wasn't going to be halfway on that. And so I thought about that because that was kind of a scary step. I didn't know what that meant. But I knew by now that I was sick. I knew by now that I was dangerous to myself. I knew that the alcohol and drugs had led me down to a life that I couldn't get out of. You know, I was stuck in a trap from which I couldn't spring myself. I was caught in a trap, and I couldn't get myself out. So, and these people in 12-step rooms were telling me a way out, and they had found a way out. And there was a lot of them I saw that were happy, and they looked free, and they looked at peace, and they had something that I wanted. There was others that didn't. The ones that seemed to talk about the steps more and do the steps and work with people and these things, they seemed to have something that I wanted. They had a glow about them, and it wasn't like a physical glow. It was like an aura about them, you know, and they radiated this peace and this freedom and this happiness that I'd never really had, you know. And I had little glimpses of that during my life, you know. Sometimes the perfect chemical combination, you could get that, you know. But I'd usually shoot right past that. But now I started kind of wanting this, you know, and I think that's the benefit of going to AA meetings, you know, where you got people practicing 12 steps. You get to see this and live in action, you know. You get to see people that have this, and you start wanting it. That's how it happened to me. And I started wanting this stuff, you know, so I started doing what they did, you know, and I started doing the steps, you know, and I did that third step, you know. And I decided when I did that third step, I was going to do whatever that meant, you know. Whatever that meant, turn my will and life over to God as I understand Him. Whatever that meant. I didn't understand God. You know, but my whatever understanding I had, I went to that and I said, okay, I'm gonna do this thing. And so then I started doing the cleanup stuff. You know, steps 4 through 9, cleaning up. You know, making looking at myself, being honest with myself. This is what I've done, and got through that, and start sharing that with another person so they could see, so I could be truthful and honest and about who I was . And then step 6 and 7, you know, turning that stuff over, giving that up to God, so to speak. And then 8 and 9, you know, making amends, going through that process, taking all those people that I'd screwed over and then showing up with my wallet in my hand and paying people back and making living apologies, you know, with my family and stuff. So this is stuff that has to be done. And to really do that step 3. This is the stuff you have to really do. And then I get through step 10, you know, and you continue to do that stuff on a daily basis. And then you come to step 11 that we're at today. You sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. You know, at the beginning of this thing, Bill talked about that we all have our own unique experience. We're all a little bit different, and we all have a slightly different experience with our beliefs, and that's kind of cool. And I heard that very early on too when I got to AA, and that's good because I'm kind of a nonconformist. You know, if you say to do this, I'm going to say I'll do it this way. You know, so and I'm a contrarian. You say this, I say this. You know, and I find a lot of alcoholics have that in them. We're like, I'm a rebel without a pause. And so I'm just looking for something to rebel against, you know. And this program, I would rebel, and they would say, okay, no big deal. You know, and do it how you want to do it. You know, and so that gave me a lot of freedom. So I didn't have a lot I could fight with about these, because I'm a fighter. So I want to fight with people about all these different issues. And so they just say, hey, do it the way you want to do it. You know, and so it took a lot of fight out, a lot of steam out, you know. So and it was God as I understood it. God as I understood it. It wasn't as you understood it. Because everybody in here has a understanding of God, and I might disagree with everybody in here their understanding of God. And that's okay. That's okay. And as we go through this process of prayer and meditation, this understanding that we have, it starts developing. And for me, I am a completely different person than the guy I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous 20-something years ago. You know, I am not the same person. And the things that I'm talking about today never entered my mind 20 years ago. You know, it says, you know, none of us are perfect. You know, the point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. And you grow at your own pace here. There's nobody can force you to grow at any particular pace. Because, you know, if somebody forces you to believe something, you're an unbeliever. You know, nobody can ever force me to truly believe. I might say something to affect them in a way that I think they want to be affected, but I'm not really a believer. You know, so I can't. Nobody can force me to believe anything. I don't believe I can force anybody else to believe anything. But I did that serenity prayer early on, and that opened my eyes to something. You know, and I saw these people in the 12-step rooms. They were talking about doing the steps, and I heard a lot of atheists and agnostics that had come to AA that were believers now, and these were hardcore atheists and agnostics. Bill Wilson, who wrote the book, and that book says, in the first 164 pages, it uses the word God 136 times. Bill Wilson wrote that. He was an atheist. And he was an atheist. And he switched over, you know. And this happens, and you see this over and over and over. You know? So we aren't necessarily who we are when we get here. And I was lost when I got here. And I was lost when I was out there, you know. And I started finding my real self here, you know. And I say selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of this whole addiction problem, you know. And today the way I look at that is that that was my lower self. And I found a higher self here, you know. And this is, you know, I found a connection to God here through learning how to pray and learning and finding my real self. And because what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is things that... You know, a book says, be quick to realize where religious people are right. And, you know, I've always heard people talking about they have a soul, or, you know, humans have a soul. And, you know, I didn't know what that meant. And, but as I started doing this program and started, made that decision to turn my life over to God, and then I started bringing prayer into my life on a daily basis, what I found was that... I started getting that connection, that soul connection. I started finding that, you know. And, you know, there's this other big book besides our big book. And in that second part of that, and they call it the New Testament, it talks about the kingdom of heaven is within. You know, the kingdom of God is within. It says, you know, if somebody tells you look here for God or look there for God, don't listen to them. It's right inside. The kingdom of heaven is inside. And that's that soul connection. We're connected right to it. And that prayer and meditation, that's what it does. It brings us right to that. You know, and for me, I am a thousand times or a million times bigger person than I was when I got here. You know, because I've expanded in that area, you know. Because I, you know, in just the plain material world, all I was meat and flesh, you know. But in the spiritual world, there's no limit to how much you can grow. And it's a phenomenal thing to find things about yourself that you don't even know when you get here. I didn't even know so much about myself. And I come here, and I find this God, and I've got this thing, and you get so much direction. You get so much positive stuff from this. I wish I could tell everybody how much you could get, but every person has to find that themselves and how much they want to put into it. But it was within. You know, I don't have to pray to something outside of myself. I can just go in, close my eyes, and get connected. And that connection will... I found that first day when I started doing that serenity prayer, I got some kind of little connection, and then I got some kind of little power over my problem. Well, that connection and that power both are things that can really grow as you participate in this program. I'm talking about myself. You know, Bill said, you know, how we take people through the steps. I've taken a lot of people through the steps, and mostly step 11 is such a personalized step. It's hard to take somebody through that particular step, and everybody has their own understanding. I've worked with agnostics, I've worked with atheists, I've worked with people with all kinds of weird spiritual beliefs and all kinds, or to me that were weird, and now mine seem weird to a lot of people, I'm sure, you know, but all that's good, you know, and so I don't get into telling anybody how to do this particular step, and other than saying, you know, what I do, you know. And what I've found for me is I like feeling comfortable. I don't like feeling miserable. And I like feeling positive. I don't like feeling negative. I like feeling happy. I don't like feeling sad. You know, I like feeling free. I don't like feeling bound up and caged up. You know, I like peace. I don't like disharmony. You know, and so these kind of things I'm able to find through prayer and meditation easily. And they come in, and I'll tell you, when I was drinking and using, any time that I ran low, you know, the buzz is starting to wear off, I knew exactly what to do. The thing to do was to pick up and take some more in and get the buzz going again. And, you know, it's the same thing with prayer and meditation, you know. If I start feeling those ways I don't want to feel, all I have to do is go back to that inner sanctum. Anyway, this is probably a... one of the least understood of the steps, especially the meditation part. I'm not going to get much into that. I practice meditation all the time now. I really enjoy it a lot. It's a very expanding type of thing. But it's probably the least understood of the 12 steps. It's probably the least talked about. You just don't hear too many people talking about meditation. But I'll tell you what, there's not one thing about this that is weak. There's not one thing about this that's unmanly. There's not one thing about this that doesn't produce more strength in your life. Men of faith, people of faith, women of faith are people of courage. They're people of strength. Way more. I'm way stronger than I was when I got here. And if you don't have that kind of strength, I'll tell you, you can't face down temptations. There's nothing weaker in the face of temptations than willpower. Willpower will fold in the face of temptation. But with this kind of spiritual strength that you can develop here, you can face literally anything. Anyway, with that, I appreciate being asked to speak here. Thank you.
Thank you, JC. I noticed several of you have been picking up the little pieces of white paper and submitting them into the basket, and I would encourage you all to do that as questions come up. That's, again, going to be a lively time for interaction with our panelists. So at this time, what I'd like to do is introduce our second panelist, and please give a warm Clary County welcome for Jill, who came all the way from Fresno today.
Hi, you guys. My name's Jill Wilson. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Thank you, Bill, for asking me to share my experience. I absolutely love talking about Step 11. It's hard for me to discuss Step 11 and my experience with working that step and continuing to work that step and working others through that step without talking about Step 10, because I feel like they go hand in hand. Real quick, I guess I could just qualify for you guys. My sobriety date, my God-given sobriety date, is December 7th, 2006. And, you know, I had no intention of of getting sober or what, I didn't even know really what that meant. I did, the only intention I had was that I knew that the drugs weren't working anymore, the gig was up, and but I was not going to stop drinking. You know, and I haven't had a drink since that date. And so I firmly believe that that was not me. I firmly believe that my sobriety date was God-given. And that was evidenced by me being taken through the book, you know, with a sponsor and really getting clear on that first step. Because for me, you know, when I was drinking and using and I continued to chase that drink, I continued to chase that feeling that I got, you know, in the first few years of my drinking, and it wasn't working. I just couldn't understand. I didn't understand that I had crossed that line, you know. I didn't understand that that really what I was trying to do was treat this internal condition. And I just thought I drank because I liked the way it made me feel. I didn't always necessarily like the consequences, but in the beginning for me, I didn't really have that many consequences. And so it was just a part of my life and I enjoyed it. But as I continued to drink and as that spiritual malady, that internal condition got bigger for me and I had to continue to drink more and more and more to be able to treat that, you know, my life got worse. And I never could connect the dots of like how I got there. Like how I was I just graduated high school and I have a scholarship and I'm going to college and within 1 year, you know, I lost that scholarship, I'm kicked out of school and I'm moving back, you know, with my family. And I never understood that like the reality for me is I was just continuing to treat that internal condition, you know, which I feel was with me probably before I ever picked up that first drink. And I can't stand here and tell you that I have any like inkling to a reason to know why I ever took, you know, take that first drink. Because if I do, if I feel like I know why I drank, you know, or I drank because of this, I drank because I was happy, because I was sad, because it was hot, cold, you know, he left me, he's sticking around, whatever it is, right there I'm separating myself, and that is a mental defense for me, because if I knew what that was, then I would just eliminate that issue and not pick up that first drink and not start that phenomenon of craving, you know, the allergy that, that the book talks about. I wouldn't start that whole cycle and then everything would be okay, but I don't. I have no idea why I would even pick up that first drink to begin with. You know, and so by the time, I got sober at 23 and it was right after I turned 23, and at that point I was, you know, I had lost everything. I was kicked out of the apartment. It was the worst apartment in the world that I was living in Hollywood. I had like no license. My friend had wrecked my car. I had been involved in a lot of criminal activity and I'd done so many things that I was not raised to do, you know. And I come from a home of it's me and my brother. I have a younger brother who's 4 years younger and my mom and my dad, and none of them are alcoholics. It's just myself. But there was a lot of love in our home, you know. I was probably well taken care of to a fault. And so there's like no outside issue to point to like why I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm an alcoholic because when I pick up that first drink, that obsession starts and that craving starts, and I don't know when I'm going to stop or if I'm going to be able to like stay stopped. That's the only reason I'm an alcoholic right there. And the book talks about that. It talks about that craving being the only thing that separates us from the normal drinker. But, you know, when all that was going on and I'm on the streets and I'm in this abusive relationship, and I don't blame him because I was abusive right back, you know, the alcohol was too important, so I didn't want to leave. But I thought that was the unmanageability in my life, that I didn't have a car and that on paper I was nobody. And, you know, I thought that was what that was. And what I didn't realize is, like, the unmanageability in my life was not those material things, was not those tangible things. And really, you know, what it was is what it talks about on page 52 in The Bedevilment. It talks about we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Couldn't make a living. And I'm not just talking about financially. Like, we couldn't live. Couldn't live at all in our own skin. Like, you know, go throughout the day. I couldn't stand it. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. That's what that internal condition was for me, and that's what the unmanageability was. And I never understood what that had to do with my alcoholism until I, you know, came into Alcoholics Anonymous and went through the big book with a sponsor. But, there were a few times throughout my drinking where I swore off forever and I prayed to a God that I don't even know if I believed in, but that seemed like the right solution at the time to get me out of whatever jam I was in. And I remember the first time I did that, I was, I wasn't raised like super religious or anything, but I had gone to jail in Mexico when I was 18 for smuggling drugs back across the border. And I would do it every weekend, so I just never thought it would happen to me. And then I got caught. And being in that jail, I was like, I don't belong here, you know. And I thought that would be reason enough for them to get me out of there, and they don't care, you know. And so that was the first time I, like, actually tried to seek some kind of God. But really what that was like, it was just like a plea, you know, like, if you get me out of here right now, I'll never drink again. I won't do drugs. I won't smoke. I won't cuss. No premarital sex. Like, anything. I would have become a nun at that point, you know, to just get out of that jail. Like I said, like, I had only seen that stuff in the movies, you know. I had no idea what was going on. You know, and there was a few other times that I begged and pleaded with a God that I did not understand. A God that wasn't personal to me, you know, just to get me out of that trouble. But other than that, I didn't really have, like, any type of, I guess, concept or whatever of a higher power until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, because I am a real alcoholic and because I can't stop on my own and I don't know when, like, how strong that craving is going to be, that powerlessness that I'm talking about, I firmly believe that my sobriety date is God-given, because if that is the case for me, then how in the heck was I able to, you know, put down the drink when I wasn't even intending on doing so? And so that was, like, my first experience, really, with the God, is once I came to understand that first step, and understood God's role in that first step, and that it wasn't my role. I was opened up just a little bit, and that was, like, the first spiritual experience I had, like, you know, coming to believe that my sobriety date is a spiritual experience in itself. You know, that God was doing for me what I obviously couldn't do for myself, because if I could have done that for myself, I would have done it before I ever hurt people, you know, before I ever threw away everything I had going for me in my life, before I ever continued to hurt my brother or take advantage of my parents. I would have stopped way before all of that, and because of that powerlessness, I couldn't. You know, so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was, like, on fire for AA, and not initially, but after the first few months, because I felt like Alcoholics Anonymous was something I was going to be able to do right, you know, like, oh, I can do this right, I can manage to screw up everything else in my life, but this thing I got, you know, and I was a very good sponsee for my sponsor for, like, the first year of my sobriety. And but there came a point around, I don't know, I think I was just about to work my third step with her and, you know, get on our knees and say that prayer, and I wasn't really feeling it. And she kept asking me to pray, like, certain times, and I would call her, and I'm like, you got anything else? Like, I'll write. I'll do a bunch of writing assignments for you. I'll have them done in an hour, you know, whatever you want me to do, but I'm not going to pray. And my whole idea about that was, like, somebody is going to see me praying or whatever and think that I'm weird. And I really felt like I didn't know how to pray, you know. And, like, people didn't think I was weird already. And what happened is that I was in this relationship. And, see, relationships can be good for your sobriety because they could get you towards God just a little bit more when they get really bad. With somebody that was, you know, active in their disease, and I just couldn't handle it anymore. And I went out to the cemetery to go visit my uncle, and he was like a dad to me. And he died of this disease. And I went out there, and I was just sitting by his grave, and I'm like, okay, if there is a God, please get me out of this relationship. And that was, like, my form of prayer, the only thing I knew how to say. And I left that cemetery, like, 30 minutes later, and about 3 hours after that, I got a phone call that guy that I was dating got arrested, and he's going to be in jail for, like, a year. And I was like, oh, my gosh, my prayer sent him to jail. And I called my sponsor, and I tell her what happened. I was like, I prayed for the first time, and he's in jail, you know? And I'm like, if I ever tell you that God doesn't work again, just remind me of this, you know? And so that was kind of like my first little experience, you know, with God. And I don't know what happened, but I continued to pray after that, you know, and you know, I and that was just like a small little experience for me, and as I have, you know, continued to stay sober and gone back and been able to like look at things and reflect on things, there's been so many more other experiences that I had, but at the time I wasn't clear enough on my condition and clear enough on my relationship with that higher power to be able to understand that, but I hit a wall, I guess, at about, I don't know, 2.5 years of sobriety, where I knew a drink wasn't going to fix anything, and I kind of had that attitude of like, is this really all AA has to offer me? Like, is my life going to be like this forever because this sucks? I was, you know, reverting back to all of those, like, I guess they call them old behaviors, but they're not old if you're still doing them type thing. You know, lying, cheating, stealing, all of that stuff in sobriety. I couldn't be honest with my sponsor because my ego was too big and I cared too much about what she thought of me. And I can honestly tell you, I felt like I was at that jumping off place that the book talks about, you know, and I really didn't want to drink. I just wanted to die, like anything to fix, to get me out of here, you know. And I was approached by somebody who's one of us, an alcoholic, and who has gone through the book and taken others through the book. And I was approached by him, and he took me through the big book as he had been taken, and I had a whole new experience with the book. And that's when I really came to understand that first step. That's where I really came to understand that the only treatment for my internal condition was God, was a spiritual solution. That's where I really came to understand that my problem wasn't the alcohol. This whole time I thought the problem was the alcohol, but once the alcohol was removed, I still was having all of these problems, and I still was behaving like I was when I was drinking, if not worse sometimes, you know, and my head was still crazy, and I couldn't shut that off, and all these ideas that I had about every little thing in life and what was supposed to be and who I was supposed to be and all of that stuff was still there. And so that's when I understood that my real problem was lack of power, you know, and it talks about that in our book, and it tells us that lack of power is our dilemma. You know, and right after that, it also tells us that that's what this book is about, is to show us how we can find that power greater than ourselves. So that's a relief for somebody like me. You know, I was kind of slow, I guess, to get this thing in the beginning, but being sober 2.5 years, you know, I think I'm like a big shot. I have 2.5 years. I should be doing good, whatever that means. I don't know. And here I am, and my life is like in shambles again. Like, I'm so absolutely grateful for that man who came and approached me and took me through the book, because I feel like, because of that experience today, my life is completely different. My life is more God-centered now, and it never was before. But the thing is that I can't just stay sober off that experience, you know, 3 years ago. Like, I have to continue to have a new experience with the book, and I have to continue to have a new experience every day. You know, with my higher power and with steps 10 and 11. And, you know, I also had this idea that step 10 was the questions that it tells us to ask ourselves on, 86 and 87. I couldn't separate the two. I didn't realize that step 10, was that present step. That's what we're doing through the day. We're doing step 10. I kind of thought that step 10 was, I guess, like when we retire at night, you know? In our book on page 84, it talks about step 10, and it says that we suggest to continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. If you would have told me that when I first got sober that I was going to have to do this for a lifetime, I would have been out the door. You know, right here, that is a blessing to me. That today it is that I get to do that for a lifetime. My life with God is just like so incredible, you know, and my life without any contact with a higher power was like, I was so miserable, and I was sober, and so I'm miserable with the drink, and I'm miserable without the drink, and it's like, what other options do I have? But it says that we continue to do this as we clean up the past, you know, and I can stand here and tell you today that I still have an 8-step list that is not finished. I still have amends that I have to make. and that's okay, you know. As I mean, if I am not willing to, you know, make those amends, then that's another issue, because then I'd probably have a drink waiting for me. But I can still continue to go on and do step 10 and 11 and 12 with having that list there, as long as I'm hacking away at it, you know. And it says, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. That whole thing about watching for those things is like a spiritual practice in itself, you know. To be able to even be aware today that maybe I am being selfish or dishonest is huge. I had to get there. You know, I had to get there by becoming clear on my first step. I had to get there by coming up with my own conception of a higher power in step two, and taking a look at all those prejudices that I had from, you know, what outside ideas or when I was young or experiences or whatever it was about God. I had to get there by in step three, really, like, you know, instead of you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and at first I was like, oh no, you know, like, that's my life. Well, like, my life ran by myself is awful. So that for me wasn't, I didn't feel like I was, like, giving up some major control, because obviously I had none to begin with, you know? I used to be like, well, I don't know what God's will is, but I sure as heck knew what God's will wasn't, you know? And I felt like that was God right there in my gut. But for me, what that was is that I could turn that over to be able to, like, feel protected to take the rest of the steps, you know, that I knew that there was a God that was going to guide me through the rest of this process, so I could begin to understand him and, that, like, the role that, you know, God has to play in my life. And that's all that was for me. And by doing that four-step inventory and becoming clear on, you know, basically on the fact that all those people that were listing down in that first column were not, I was tricked, you know, in the beginning. I thought I was listing those people down so I could really tell my sponsor exactly how much of an a-hole they were, you know. But the reality of it was that I was just looking for those patterns to see what my defects were, you know. And so I had to become clear on those things that those bedevilments that I talked about in the beginning, you know. I had to be clear on those defects in my life and how they were driving my behavior and my thoughts and my ideas and my actions, and share those with a sponsor, you know, and really be willing to have God remove those, you know, like, earnestly, like, seek God to remove those, because it drives me nuts. I'm going to be honest with you, and if you don't like what I'm saying, I'm sorry, but I hate when I hear people say, like, oh, I'm working on my character defects. Like, what are you working on? Like, what are you doing to work on them? You know, and how are you doing that? Because in my experience with the book and with working these steps, like, that's God's job. You know, that's God's job to remove those. And sometimes I have, you know, some around, sometimes some are gone, and sometimes some like to hang out together. I don't know, but if I could have removed those myself, I would have done it a long time ago. You know, if I could have removed that defect that I have of more, I probably wouldn't have been an alcoholic. You know, and so it's like, I can't work on them, but I can do the work to get to God, to ask God to remove them, you know, and this whole thing keeps going back to God, you know. It's like, I don't have this power, but I have access to tap into this power that can change all kinds of things in my life. I mean, he's already separated me from the drink. I'm recovered, you know. I'm recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But in the book, it talks about how being sober isn't enough, and I'm a perfect example of that, you know, that just staying away from the alcohol isn't enough. We have to clean up that wreckage, you know, and we have to continue to be willing to grow in whatever direction God wants us to go in. But so for step 10, being able to, I had to get clear on all of those things to be able to see, you know, like, to be able to actually practice that watching. I feel like that's a spiritual practice, watching for the selfishness, the dishonesty, the resentment, and fear. And the coolest thing is that when those things come up, you know, it's not, I have a relationship with God today where I can seek whatever I need to seek, whatever answer I need, and take the corrective measures. It doesn't knock me off track. I don't have to go drink over it. You know, how cool is that? Before, it's like I wanted to drink if somebody looked at me wrong, you know? And I don't have to do that because of the promises it talks about in the book. And it talks about them in this section right here on 84. It says that, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. So we're recovered. or recover. We're not recovering. If we're going to spend our whole lives recovering, it's like, what's the point of this deal, you know? For by this time, sanity will have returned, and we will seldom be interested in liquor, and if we're tempted, we recoil from it as if it's from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. Now, that's a good promise, right? And we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not sworn off. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. The drink problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react. So as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So there's a catch. Like that is, those are amazing promises, and they are available to anybody who, you know, who wants to seek a higher power. But we have to continue to do that. And it says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. And that's what I was talking about, trying to recreate that experience, you know. I'm not going to stay sober, and I'm not going to, you know, be able to tap into that power to live if I'm trying to live off an experience I had 2.5 years ago. And that's why we continue to work these steps. That's why this process continues, you know. That's why, like, we have the opportunity to work with other alcoholics, you know. I know for me, when I'm working with another alcoholic, that's where God is. And so every day I must have that new experience, and what that is for me is step 11. In our book, it talks about how we can exercise our willpower along this line. All we wish is the proper use of the will. And so it's not like we're powerless, doomed forever, you know. We have tapped into a power which allows us to do all kinds of things. I can make decisions for myself. I don't have to call my sponsor and ask her what kind of toilet paper to buy, or if I should buy a new car, or if I should get married, or whatever. You know, that's not how this thing is, because that's a human power. And now we have tapped into this power that, you know, not only has removed the drink problem for us, but has all kinds of structures to build in our life. And so, you know, I have that intuitive thought, you know what I'm talking about, that I can make decisions. I become God conscious. And then what it tells us that we must go further, and that means more action. And so that brings us to step 11, prayer and meditation. I have a hard time with the 12 and 12, with this whole deal with step 11. It talks about being near a sunlit beach and blah, 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 all that stuff. I'm not discounting it if it works for you guys, but for me it was like I'm like crazy enough as it is. I wasn't going to be able to sit down and picture myself next to a beach and say the St. Francis prayer and call it a day. For me, I had to really be consistent. And the consistency of step 11 for me is what has really changed my life. And what it tells us to do, and you know, and this is how Bill wanted us to talk about how he would take somebody else through this step. And JC kind of hit the nail on the head. It's kind of like a personal, your own personal experience. But what I do with, you know, like the women that I sponsor is I take them through the book. And that's where the directions are. Like, I don't have any other outside material that I'm using for this step 11. You know, that's between me and God. But I do have, like, an outline right here of what I'm supposed to do. It tells us when we retire at night. So that's the first part of it. I used to think this thing was kind of backwards. Like, why is it not when we wake up in the morning and then when we go to bed at night, you know? But that's because we're looking at that stuff that we've watched for in the 10th step. And it tells us to ask ourselves, were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves that should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. You know, that will destroy me. That will destroy my usefulness to others when I'm constantly sitting around reflecting on the past and not taking the corrective action, you know, by either making amends or getting honest with somebody or doing whatever I need to do to fix that. That morbid reflection will destroy me. And it blocks me out from God, and it blocks me out from being useful to other people. It says, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. So that's at night. Now, in the morning, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. So that's in the morning, you know, upon awakening, that's what I do. You know, I ask God to direct my thinking before I start out on my day. Because if not, chances are, you know, I'm not going to have that intuitive thought or that insight on what I'm really supposed to be doing. You know, I need to let God outline that for me. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. And that's what I'm talking about, you know. Having a reliance on a higher power for me, I am able to do that. I'm able to make decisions. I'm able to, you know, not freak out when I don't know what to do. It's just a simple, I just pause, you know, and like, okay, God, show me what the next step is here, you know. It's as easy as that. And our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. You know, when my thinking is not cleared of wrong motives, I make decisions based on self all the time. And what our book tells us, when we do that, that we're going to place ourselves in a position to be hurt. It goes on to talk about when we face indecision, what we do. And you know, we just are able to pause and ask God for an intuitive thought or action. We just come to rely on it. And the final paragraph, it says, we usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. You know, I like I said, I feel like this is like a personal step. I don't believe that there's a right or wrong way to have a relationship with God, whatever that is to you. And that's why this deal works around here. You know, we don't have a monopoly on the type of God that anybody has to believe in. So it's open to everybody. It's open to everybody. You can. It does not matter. But what matters is that you are willing to, like, turn and face that higher power and seek that higher power. Because not only does that matter because you most likely are going to drink again, or you're going to die. You know, it talks about that we have two choices, to die of an alcoholic death or live by spiritual principles. But even more than that, like once the drink problem has been removed, like we get to live life, like we get to make a living. You know, and I know that for me when I was out there drinking, I wasn't making a living. I was miserable. So many things have happened in my life that, like, now it's just, I mean, all the credit goes to God, you know, and things that I never had any idea about, you know, or I never knew that I would have the opportunity to experience. And taking somebody through this step, you know, what I started to do with my sponsor is that I would do the work, I answer those questions, you know, like I just read, and then I emailed them to him at a certain time of the day, like right in the morning, actually, after I did my prayer meditation. And then I would call at a certain time at, like, I don't know, 10 o'clock, actually, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And we would go over, and he would email his to me, you know, so it's kind of like a buddy check thing here with our Step 11 considerations. I know I've got a computer up here. I did print this out off my email because I know Bill had said if we had any other materials. But it is just the questions from the book, taken right out of the book. There's nothing added to it. We didn't get this from anywhere else but the big book. And basically, I just go over those considerations, you know, with my sponsor. And if anything came up that I might need some direction on, you know, he would point that out or I would ask. And really, for me, what that was about consistency. It was about really calling at 10 o'clock when I said I was going to. Really doing what I said I was going to with this work. Because as I continued to stay consistent, my relationship with God started to develop even further. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, right. You know, on the bottom of page 87, it says, if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend that also. Basically, like what JC said, you know, be quick to see where religious people are right. And there's no monopoly on that either. You know, you're free to believe in whatever you want to believe. I feel like the most important thing is having that relationship with a higher power so you can stay sober, because if you're drinking, like, these things really aren't possible, you know? And because no human power can restore us to sanity, because that self-reliance has failed in all aspects of our lives, like, the only other solution there left is to die or have a God solution, you know? Real quick, and then I'll shut up. I read that bottom part because I used to get nervous, like, to go into church. I go to church now, but especially in, like, my first year, I would only go on, like, my mom's birthday and one other day because she wanted me to, and I was just trying to, like, get her off my back. That's wrong motive. And I would get so nervous when I got in there, and I thought, like, the walls were going to burn down, and everybody in that church knew what I had done and knew where I had been, and they'd say, okay, greet your neighbor, and I would either run my ass to the bathroom or, like, start digging in my purse so nobody would talk to me. Like, that is not living. You know, that is a complete fear of people and a big ego that anybody in that church even cared about me or knew who I was, right? I don't think they even noticed I was there. But this is what has changed for me, is that because of these steps and because of this process of getting me to a God of my own understanding and consistently seeking that God, like, I go to church now regularly. I don't run away when they tell us to greet our neighbor. I want to sometimes, but I don't. But I pray with my fiance, and I did not think I was going to be praying with anybody. You know, that was just not an option for me. And now it's, like, not an option for me not to, because that's where I want our relationship to be built, you know, is that foundation of God. And he's not one of us, and I'm rather glad. But I had to, like, test the waters with a few people, relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous, before I figured that out. Good Lord. But having our relationship based on that contact with God has been amazing. And I, at one point when we first started seeing each other, I really felt like he was just in my life to strengthen my relationship with God, because he was an example of such a strong faith. And I was okay with that, you know. I wasn't worried about controlling him and, like, you know, what's going to happen with our relationship and what happens if we break up, because that, my ideas had changed. And, you know, and so that is something that has changed in my life, besides the fact that I'm employable. I work for my dad. I have a key to the drawer of our shop, you know? That's where all the money is. And I pick it up, and I take it to him, and nothing's ever missing. At 2.5 years of sobriety, I can stand up here and tell you that it probably wouldn't have been the case. That's how affected my life was by those bedevilments, you know? You know, I work with other alcoholics, which is extremely important, And I help people outside of this program too, because that's where this example needs to be carried. You know, it's not just within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been able to get an understanding of that. And you know, I'm going to share one little story. Is that I have a little Chihuahua, and he's been with me for like 10 years, and I, like, from when I first, like, really got heavy into the drinking and using. And recently he had, like, a little eye problem, and so I had taken him to the vet, and this vet was a jerk, and I'm resentful at him still, I think. But he's like, I saw dog legs this last week, and they had a tumor in their eye, so you just probably need to get his eye taken out. Okay, well, he's talking about my child. And so I completely lose it in the middle of the vet's office, like, snot and tears, and, like, the vet assistants are crying too because I'm hysterical. And I leave, and I'm like, I'm going to get a second opinion, you know. I just didn't want to believe that was the truth. And so I went and got a second opinion by a vet that has amazing bedside manner. And she's, like, my new favorite person in the world. And, you know, she took a look at my dog, and she was like, you know, no, he doesn't have a tumor, but the lens of his eye basically came detached, and it went in the front of his eye. And the only treatment for this is you can drive to UC Davis, where there's a dog eye specialist. It's going to cost about $6,000, and we can't guarantee that he's going to have any sight in that eye. He'll be able to keep his eye, and you probably have to stay there for like 5 days, and you have to get there in less than 24 hours to preserve any little sight he might have left, or you can take his eye out. And because that's my child and more important to me than almost anybody, I thought, okay, cool, I'm going to go to UC Davis. I drove home and started getting my stuff together. I wanted to go, And I took a minute, and I sat on my bed, and I'm like a wreck, you guys. I have not been this much of a wreck. I couldn't stop crying, and I sat there, and I got with God, and I'm like, what am I supposed to do here, you know? And the answer came to me that, you're getting married in November, and you're going to go wipe out $6,000 out of your savings account right now to take a little 25% chance that your child, my dog child, I might be saved, you know. And at that moment, like, as much as the reality sucked for me, I knew that was the most selfish thing to do. That I was about to, like, go take a big chunk of money out of my savings account, and I'm getting married, and I have expenses for that, you know, and I'm going to come into this relationship, you know, I need to be financially self-supporting and all this stuff. And so I was super bummed out about that, but I knew it was the right decision to make. And so I went back to the vet and scheduled an appointment to have my dog's eye taken out. And I was to take him back the next morning. And so by this point, I haven't slept for 48 hours. And I stayed awake all night, and I was just praying and rubbing my dog's back. He's like this big, you guys. He's just so sweet. And I dropped him off the next morning at the vet to get his eye taken out, and I'm still in, like, hysterics. And I get a phone call from the vet 15 minutes after I dropped him off, and now I'm like, he's dead. Like, she screwed up the anesthesia, and she killed my dog, and now I don't like this vet anymore, you know? And she asked me, what did you do last night? And I got defensive. I'm like, nothing. Like, I did everything you said, and I stayed awake. Like, I still haven't slept. I rubbed his back, and I prayed all night. And she's like, well, I've never seen this in my years of veterinary practice, but his limbs went back into place, and I just don't know how that's possible. And I was like, quiet, you know, and I was like, and the only thing I could think of was that I prayed all night, you know, I don't know. I mean, I know God performs miracles because I'm up here today, and you guys are all here today. But I mean, like, I couldn't believe it, and the whole office was like beside themselves, you know, that they had never seen this, and all the cloudiness in his eye is gone, she said, and it was all white, and now it's all clear, and he can see fine, and so I got to go home and pick my dog up, and she put him on some antibiotics, and now he's back to, like, the same old dog, and I call him my little miracle chihuahua. But for me, like, that was just huge evidence of a God that works, you know, but I feel like because of the consistency of steps 10 and 11, like, I'm not saying that was my reward, but I feel like that was just a clear message to me that, you know, like, God can do all kinds of things, you know, if I seek God. Like, God can do all kinds of things for me, and that on my power alone, I can't do that myself, you know. And so it was just kind of one of those lessons for me that how important this stuff is, not only to solve, you know, to separate us from the drink problem, but really to, like, solve our life problem, you know, to treat that internal condition that I used to treat with alcohol. And as I treat it with alcohol, and it gets bigger and bigger, and no amount of alcohol is fixing it. Like, God is so big that there is a ton of an amount of God to fix that internal condition for me, you know? And I really hope that with you guys, like, you know, you can find that too. Especially, I usually try to remember all the newcomers' names, but there was a ton of you guys, and I started going, I got to, like, number 7, and I thought, I'm screwed up. So welcome to you guys. You know, I hope that you guys have found what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the steps, you know, the steps that have gotten me to that loving God, you know, that I continue to seek on a daily basis. So thank you. Thank you, Bill.